Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow, this year just kind of seems to be tumbling fast, this breakneck pace, and just there's always all kinds of stuff going on every day. Doesn't seem to let up. The volcanoes in Hawaii. Can you get a little more, 10 more climb? Doing our best, Chuck.
Sit closer, Chuck.
More craziness out of Washington. So I thought I would open today with a poem from Mary Oliver. It's titled Spring. Somewhere a black bear has just risen from sleep and is staring down the mountain. All night, in the brisk and shallow restlessness of early spring, I think of her, her four black fists flicking the gravel, her tongue like a red fire touching the grass, the cold water. There is only one question: how to love this world. I think of her rising like a black and leafy ledge to sharpen her claws against the silence of the trees. Whatever else my life is, with its poems and music and its cities, it is also this dazzling darkness coming down the mountain, breathing and tasting. All day I think of her, her white teeth, her wordlessness, her perfect love. Oops, there we go. One more click. I would like to invite you now into a time of reflection and meditation. And if you're comfortable doing so, close your eyes. Relax in your chair. Take a couple of long, slow, deep breaths. And find that still, small, quiet place within you. These words for our meditation today come from Janet Carlson Bull. Love is knotted and gnarled, like an old tree fighting with the wind. Like branches too brittle for their own good, like roots that relentlessly inform how deeply we can trust and how freely we can forgive. And I invite you to open your heart in the spirit of forgiveness. Perhaps there is someone you would like to forgive or need to forgive. Perhaps there is some god or goddess that needs forgiveness. Perhaps there is something that you would like to forgive yourself for. And now, in this moment, you have the space to do that. is one of those words that I confess I find a little annoying and frustrating from time to time. It's both a noun and a verb. It is both specific and general. It is precise yet ambiguous. It is powerful and yet weak. In both speaking and hearing the word, we attach lots of different meanings to it, and that can get us into a lot of trouble. Now, the Greeks had more than one word that translates as love, which is far more useful. There's storge, empathic or familial love, which is the affection through the fondness of familiarity, that of family members, or people who relate in familiar ways, who have otherwise found themselves bonded by chance. An example of this is the natural love and affection of a parent for their child and a child for their parent. And the Greeks saw this as the most natural, emotive, and widely diffused of loves. There's friendly love, philia, the strong bond which exists between people who share common values, like us, interests or activities, friends, colleagues, comrades at arms. And there's eros, the romantic, passionate love driven by desire. And we're all familiar with these kinds of love. They're a central part of what makes us human, essential to the human condition. They bring us both pain and joy, disappointment and delight. And then there's the Greek word for divine love, agape. In Christian theology, this is the love of God for humanity. In a broader sense, it's that universal, unconditional love which persists regardless of changing circumstances. And this kind of love shows up in one form or another in many cultures and many places. And this is what we talk about when we talk about love in Unitarian Universalism. And it is very specifically grounded in our Universalist heritage. Universalist Christians believed in universal salvation, that a just and loving God would not, could not, condemn anyone to eternal torment, that all souls were eventually reconciled with God. And this was in very sharp contrast to the prevailing belief that salvation was for the elect, and that morality depended upon fear, that people would not act decently without the threat of punishment at the hands of an angry God. Indeed, there was a time you could get out of jury duty by being a universalist. People thought you couldn't possibly judge moral issues if you believed in divine forgiveness. There's a story told about an exchange between the prominent Universalist preacher Jose Avalu and a more traditional religionist. And the man said, "Brother Balu, if I were a Universalist and feared not the fires of hell, I could hit you over the head, steal your horse and saddle, and ride away, and I'd still go to heaven." Jose Avalu looked at him and said, "If you were a Universalist, the idea would never occur to you." Love that story. But this idea of universal salvation is still suspect. It's still considered heretical. And not too long ago, you may remember that the evangelical pastors Rob Bell, Carlton Pearson, were driven from their churches when they dared to preach the message of universal reconciliation and to question the torments of hell. But they weren't preaching anything new, really. Hear these words of the early Universalist minister, Elhanan Winchester, published in 1788. How dreadful the thought that God should punish his creatures to all eternity without having the least design for their good or happiness. Can a wise and good God punish for no purpose, but merely to satisfy what they call vindictive justice, which they say can never be satisfied to all eternity? Endless misery seems to reflect upon the character of God, and for that very reason, I cannot believe it to be true. The idea of universal salvation expanded into the idea of a more inclusive religion based on universal love. Because if God loves everybody unconditionally, then how can we aspire to less? That aspiration led many universalists to be early advocates for many social reforms. The abolition of slavery, women's rights, prison reform. Sojourner Truth's "Ain't I a Woman" speech was given at a women's rights convention held at a universalist church. Clara Barton, the first president of the American Red Cross, was a universalist. The universalists were the first to ordain women, and by the time women gained the right to vote in this country in 1920, 88 women had been ordained as universalist ministers, while the Unitarians had ordained just 42, which was still a big accomplishment.
Yeah.
That's not new. And by that time, the Universalists were contending, and contending very strongly, that the hell we must concern ourselves with is not hell in the next world, but the hell we humans create right here on Earth. And so we are called to love the hell out of this world. Not my language. So hold that thought, because I want to pause and weave in a few other threads before I return to it. And the first of these is that our theology is obviously no longer completely Judeo-Christian. We hold that lineage as one of our sources, if not the primary source. But I don't want to forget that our journey as a faith has taken us through humanism, and also draws from many other sources. Humanism asks the question, what is the source of our values and ethics? And it answers that our ethical values are derived from human needs and interests as tested by experience. They arose from our evolutionary history as social animals. Being social animals, humans needed rules for living together. And the basic rule is that we must not behave in an antisocial manner. That we should help and support our fellow members of society and act not for ourselves alone, but for family and friends and the whole community. Because we succeeded not as individuals, but as groups. One of the more obvious proofs of this is that we see similar values and ethical constraints across all human cultures, theist and non-theist. Another question it asks is, who or what will save us? If not ourselves? No one, it answers. Which aligns remarkably well with the universalist insistence on humanity solving humanity's problems, rather than waiting on or relying on God's aid. And humanism is also concerned with love. To quote Michael Werner, past president of the American Humanist Association, "For all the talk about reason and science, humanism is really about a passionate love affair. It is a love affair with life, not a mythical hereafter. Humanism is a love affair with a progressive vision of civilization, where each of us can add to our growing library of wisdom, our evolving knowledge of what there is, and what is truly important. None of the great achievements in history would have been possible without a love of the adventure of learning and of creating a better life. We have great cultural achievements in science, art, music, literature, philosophy, history, psychology, and political thought that all inform each other and were born of that long humanist tradition." He goes on to say, "Humanism is merely that ongoing, evolving life stance that challenges us beyond atheism, beyond our own self-centeredness, and beyond our own fear of larger commitments to embrace the best of what we and society can be. Some have neglected to use the full breadth of humanism's resources. Some would see science answering everything we need to know, but that ignores the many tools the humanities have given us. Democracy and the concepts of human rights are gifts of history and civilization. Philosophy gives us tools for critical thinking and a conceptual framework. Literature and art heightens our awareness about what values are important. As Curtis Rees, one of the founders of modern-day humanism, said, we must relate to others in a purposeful fashion in order to weave the best personal values into a noble social order. And what is beloved community, if not a vision of a noble social order? Another thread I want to weave in this morning comes from another source, Peruvian Andes. And two of the foundational principles of their culture is expressed by their mystics and shamans. And there are many other principles, and they work with the complex religious and social technologies. But I want to keep things simple. The first of these is Munai, which could be translated as love, but simply means unconditional acceptance. Unconditional acceptance of what? Everything. Everyone. Yes, even those other people. You know the ones I'm talking about. The second is Aini, which is the principle of reciprocal sharing based on respect for every living thing and whose desired outcome is that all interactions, social, personal, energetic, and commercial, be mutually beneficial. Win-win. So we see another culture trying to build a noble social order, as I think are all peoples in one fashion or another. And lastly, before I return to where I left off, I want to return to the concept of agape. Now, it's not surprising that a number of theologians have spent quite a lot of time on this subject. Theologians love to analyze and debate the finer points of scripture and meaning, which is a good thing because it keeps them off the streets and out of trouble. And although they don't agree on everything, most of them agree that what distinguishes this higher love from the other kinds of love is how it reciprocates. Agape is about right action in response to the realities of the world. Agape returns evil with good, with forgiveness and healing. It returns with that which serves the greater good, with that which is mutually beneficial. And so we see how these threads begin to converge and weave themselves into a strong and beautiful cloth. So, back to this business of loving the hell out of the world. The most helpful way to talk about this kind of love is to say it promotes overall well-being, the survival and the flourishing of all sentient beings, because all beings want to survive and flourish. It's in their nature. It's in our nature. It's what evolution designed us to desire. And this love does not require us to feel all warm and fuzzy about people or things or events. I think this trips a lot of us up. Because we're human, we have those kinds of feelings, and they can help, but they sometimes get in the way. Especially if we have this expectation that love requires us to feel all warm and fuzzy. But love asks us to accept things as the way they are, people as the way they are. And we don't necessarily have to like them or agree with them or support their actions. And we don't need to feel affection, but we have to meet them with open hearts. And love requires us to reciprocate in mutually beneficial ways, which means being absolutely and utterly inclusive. And one last thing. Love is not enough. Love defines the field of action, as it were, and it helps guide our actions. But we also need to bring our intellects, our reason, our compassion, and our understanding to the field of action. Love must be balanced and measured by these things so that it can be effective and create lasting change, to create a just and noble social order. It takes all of our gifts and our talents and our skills to love the hell out of this world. And that's what we mean when we talk about love. Mm-hmm. Maybe so. Our closing words this morning come to us from Olympia Brown. Dear friends, stand by this faith. Work for it and sacrifice for it. There is nothing in all this world so important to you as to be loyal to this faith, which has placed before you the loftiest ideals, which has comforted you in sorrow, strengthened you for a noble duty, and made the world beautiful for you. Do not demand immediate results, but rejoice that you are worthy to be entrusted with this great message, and that you are strong enough to work for a great, true principle without counting the cost. Go on finding ever new applications of these truths and new enjoyments in their contemplation.